Will you please help me open this meeting with a moment of silence followed by the serenity prayer? Serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Is there anyone at this meeting for the first time or any visitors who would like to introduce themselves by their first name?
My name is Walter, by the way.
Hey, Walter.
Glad you're here. Glad you're here. I think everybody else is fairly regular. The Meridian Group believes sponsorship is an essential part of recovery. If there's anyone willing to be a sponsor, please raise your hand. If you're in need of a sponsor, please look around the room and visit with one of these potential sponsors after the meeting. I've asked Ronnie to come up and read how it works from chapter 5 of the Big Book. When we get to the steps in the reading, we will go around the room so that everyone can participate by reading the steps. I will get out of the way.
Okay, so we're going to pass the steps around.
Yeah, he's
off the wall. Hello, everyone. My name is Ronnie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Ronnie.
Even though I don't look like one. How it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery.
We admitted. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable.
Two, and believe that power greater than ourselves can restore
us to sanity. Three, made the decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood it.
Four, made the searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, made the God for ourselves to understand the best nature of our lives. Six, are entirely ready.
We try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Many of us exclaim, "What an order, I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to go along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought.
I'm going to read the 12 traditions for us. All right, Mike.
How do you go, Mike?
My name is Mike. I'm an alcoholic.
Hello, Mike.
I'd like to thank David for asking me to read the 12 traditions. The 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous, short form. 1. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4. Each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Ronnie.
Where did it go?
It disappeared.
There it is.
All right. Seventh tradition reminds us we're self-supporting to our own contributions. You got a paper need signing, stick it in the basket and we'll take care of it too. If somebody could start the clipboard around, we need to start signing up for September. We've only got a few meetings that are signed up for. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Thursdays. If you'd like to chair a meeting, please sign on the dotted line. AA-related announcements are on the whiteboard over here and on the boards and on the table in the hallway. Particular note, we have flyers for the Brazos Riverside Conference and for Intergroups Family Fun Festival, which is September 17th. Intergroup is also looking for some trustees to start serving two-year terms in January. If you're interested or know of anybody that's interested, holler at me or Cole. Group conscience 2 weeks from the night. Normal time, Gary? Okay. Well, you're coordinator. Sort of. Anybody else have any AA-related announcements?
Yeah,
Ron.
Jess is coming to West. We moved from
Coleman to the
library. Okay. I saw that. It'll be in next month's newsletter, so we'll have to get the word out. All right. This is birthday night, a celebration of sobriety and yearly links of sobriety. We've got three people on the board tonight, but it looks like only one of them is here, and that's because he was kidnapped and drug over here. Colby came into this group and is celebrating 5 years. He's currently living in Waco. All signs are that he's still clean and sober and doing well. So let's give Kobe a hand for 5 years.
Then Lanny has been a fixture of this group for some time. He was at AWOL for a while, but he now has put together 1 year and is also doing very well. He gets down here from Cleveland whenever he gets the chance. Money's tight, just like it with everybody, so he doesn't get to come down much. But let's give Lanny a hand.
Lanny.
All right, and it's a privilege on this next one. This fellow is celebrating 41 years of sobriety and is also our speaker, so I get to do two introductions in one, and then I get to sit down. This is a fellow that was here when I came in, and he's always been there. He's always been there for me. Anytime I needed an old-timer's shoulder to lean on or cry on or whine to, he's always been there. And he never let me do any of that without giving me some solutions. And funny thing is, those solutions always seem to work. He's one of the most kind and gentle people I've ever known in this program, and I'm just honored that he's a friend of mine, that he got to come over tonight. He can't drive at night like he used to. He was a pretty regular fixture here for quite a while, but we made sure we got him over here, didn't we, Drew? So I've got, not only do I have a 41-year chip, when I was at Intergroup the other day, I saw this chip, and it has an engraving of the man on the bed with Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob, and on the back it says, "Recovery begins when one alcoholic talks with another alcoholic, sharing experience, strength, and hope." You've done that for me for over 19 years, and I'm proud to call you a friend. Come up and get your chips and tell us your story.
He kicks back. I'm Jerry, and I am an alcoholic.
Okay.
And I don't know what you expect to hear, but I know the sum total of my story is that if I can make it, anybody can, if they will just apply themselves a little bit. I originally came to the program in the United States Penitentiary, Leavenworth, Kansas. This was after I had been classified by the United States government as an incorrigible, habitual, and criminally insane. And under the definition of criminally insane, while I was under the influence of alcohol, I definitely was criminally insane. It was my fifth time to go to the penitentiary. And every time I went to the penitentiary, it was behind drinking and things that I did while I was drunk. When I got there, it was like old home week. I knew damn near everybody there. And that is not something that you find yourself being proud of. There I was again, for I promised myself I would never do anything to send myself back there. And I couldn't even keep a promise that I'd made to myself that nobody else knew anything about. There just wasn't anything left. There was a man that worked in the hospital that owed me a couple of favors from another penitentiary. And I told him I needed some poison to waste a dude. And he got it for me. And I took that poison. And all it did to me was made my head ache like hell. My heart was beating about 90 miles an hour. And then I got sick and I heaved my insides out. About that time they came and they took me out of the cell. And they found the bottle. They knew what I had taken. They took me to the hospital and they took some blood. The doctor came to me, and I had worked for that doctor at one time in another penitentiary. And he said, Jerry, you only have another 15 or 20 minutes to live. Do you want to talk to a minister or a priest? Or do you want me to notify anybody? And I told him no. He gave me what I wanted, and I was happy. Needless to say, I didn't die. I went through a week of two teams of doctors running tests, trying to find out why I didn't die. And at the end of that week, I still had enough of that poison in my system to kill the normal person. I know today why I didn't die. And I'll get to that later on. Because I had tried to kill myself and it was against the rules and regulations, they put me in solitary confinement on bread and water. And you go in there with what the good Lord gave you. That's it. And it's a rough concrete floor. There is no mattress. After 21 days with a bologna sandwich and some cold potatoes once every 3 days, the rest of the time just bread and water, I was slimmed down pretty much like a greyhound. They usually let you out about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, so you have to wait until child's 6 o'clock in the evening. And they put you in the cell block. Well, they put me in the penthouse. 11 penthouse is the fifth tier of the cell block. It's a long way up, a long way down. No elevators. Heat and stink go up. I am standing on the fifth tier trying to get the nerve to jump, and I know I can't do it because I'm afraid I'll just mess myself up some more and have to live. There's nothing like being defeated at making a sincere attempt at killing yourself and failing. I think I called God everything under the sun because I didn't die. A man came walking up that I served time with in another penitentiary. He had the bunk next to me in that penitentiary. We looked out for each other's back. He was known to be a real mean dude. He's what we called a touch hog. And when he got out of Terre Haute on his way to California, he got to drinking. And in Oklahoma, he robbed a couple of banks. And the president of one of those banks had a heart attack and died during the robbery. And Larry became number one on the 10 most wanted list. Larry took one look at me and he says, Jerry, you're either going to go ahead and jump, you're going to make a decision to do something with yourself, or I'm going to throw you. And I was afraid he'd throw me. And I knew I couldn't jump. So I made a decision real quick with not too much conviction. He informed me that I was an alcoholic and a junkie. And I was going to go to AA. And I had some choice words for him, and he shot every one of them down. He told me I was going to go to school. And I had some choice words for that, and he shot them all down. He told me when a guard told me to do something, I was going to smile, say yes, sir, and hum, whistle, or sing while I was doing it, and not tell how his wife earned her money and how many nickel rolls she needed to roll up her proceeds. And I had some choice words for him. He said, no. He said, you've been doing that. They kick you in your ass. They work your kidneys over. They take your clothes away from you. They put you on the concrete. They feed you bread and water. And they go home and laugh about it to their wife. Who's winning? And I couldn't argue with him. He said, on top of that, if you'll do it, it'll drive them up the wall. And that was enough to get me started. Larry knew how to motivate me. It wasn't 15 minutes later, a guard told me to grab the mop bucket and a mop and mop the flag. This is a cell block that holds 900 men. It's no small place. And that floor down there around that cell block is no small place. It's about a 3-hour job to mop it. And I grabbed the mop bucket and the mop, and I started humming and I started singing, and I smiled all the way through it. And the guard would not let me get to where he could not see me. And that just fascinated the hell out of me. I was more afraid of having someone make fun at me if I failed. So I picked the hardest subject they had in school, where if I failed, I wouldn't be the only one. And lo and behold, I carried straight A's. Because of the straight A's, I was selected to take a course to become an instructor. And I passed that. And I passed my Kansas vocational certification exam. And I became an instructor in the education department. I made a lot of changes, but I never worked the steps. And when they mentioned God, I didn't want to hear anything about it. Come time for me to go up for parole, and I was not going to apply for parole. 5-time losers who had intentionally violated parole twice while he was drunk and would call and make fun of him just doesn't stand much of a chance, period. And Larry would not let me off the hook. Got down close to where I had to have the application in, and he cornered me. And for the first time in my life, I got honest with him. He wanted to know why I hadn't filled out an application. And I looked at him, and I told him, Larry, I don't know what to put on it. And he just hee-hawed. I remember I had his exact comment, asshole, put down the truth. That had never crossed my mind. They asked some fairly simple questions. Why are you applying for parole? What are your intentions of giving a parole? Why do you think you deserve a parole? And what is your version of the offense for which you were charged? Well, the reason I was applying for parole was I wasn't going to tell myself no anymore, that somebody else was going to have to tell me. If given a parole, I intend to try and make it. The reason I deserved parole was I knew of no reason. And my version of the offense for which I was charged was the record was fairly true and accurate to the best of my knowledge. And I sent it in. A month and a half later, I went before the parole judge. It was in December of 1967. And I get ushered into the room, and my caseworker tells me to have a seat. The parole judge throws my parole application at me. And one note, that was my signature. And I told him, yes, sir. He says, is there anything on there that you want to change? Shit, I wanted to change everything, but I told him, no, sir. He says, if you were given a chance, do you think you could make it? And I got honest with him. I told him, sir, I wish I could tell you yes, but I don't know. All I know is I want to try. He turned to my caseworker and he said, do you want to tell him or do I tell him? And I figured I was going to get a year setback. Caseworker says, you tell him. He says, your parole has been granted and you will be going to Houston, Texas to the Free Release Center. And you'll be leaving here on February the 8th, 1968. As you put on there that you're not going to tell yourself no, someone else will have to. You had better make it, because in the future, the answer will always be no. And they said, you can go. I remember walking out the door. The next thing I know, I'm looking up at that same doctor that treated me for trying to kill myself. I had passed out, fell on my face, broke my nose, broke two teeth, cut above my right eye. And he looked at me and he said something that made me about half pissed off at him. He's going to be okay. He's got a grin on his face. They took me to the hospital. They sewed me up. They set my nose. They gave me a choice. I could spend the night in the hospital, or I could go back to the cell block, or I could go back to work. And I decided to go back to work. Prior to my leaving Leavenworth, Larry cornered me. And he told me, he said, "Jerry, when you get out there and you don't know what to do, go to your parole officer, make him help you. Don't let him earn his money doing nothing." And that was a reason enough for me to go and do that. I was sick, extremely sick. I did not drink from March of 1966 until August of 1970. In August of 1970, I was more miserable than I had ever been drinking. And I just couldn't see any reason to go on. And I went out and I got drunk. But it didn't help. I was still just as miserable. I came to the realization I didn't want to be drunk. I just didn't want to hurt so damn much. And I called my sponsor. I told him, "Finchie, I need help." And he said, "We know you need help. The question is, do you want help?" I told him, "Yes." He said, "Did you learn anything?" I said, "Yes, I don't know how to stay sober and be happy." He said, "Well, fantastic, asshole. Now you can learn. Meet me at the Travis Club at 6:30 tomorrow evening. Put your ass to bed and you're drunk." Hung the phone up on me. That next night, he set me down. He talked to me. And he told me we were going to take the first three steps. When he come to the third step, he had me down on my hands and knees with people milling around, and I felt like a whore in church. And after reciting the third step prayer, he said, "You know, Jerry, I know you don't believe. You don't have to believe. All you have to do is be willing and willing to ask." He said, "I'm going to ask you to do something for me. I'm going to ask you to pray to my God. And I'll even tell you what to pray." And he says, "I'm not asking you to believe. I'm asking you to do it for me. And you ask my God to give you the knowledge of his will for you and the willingness to do it and to help you stay sober. And at night, you thank him." And I did it. And things started happening. Within 30 days, I wasn't praying to Frenchie's God anymore. I was praying to one that I didn't understand, but I knew he was mine. It's been uphill ever since. There's been a lot of things come down the pipe during the years, but I've been able to go through them without getting drunk. I went through a divorce. I went through getting injured on the job, not being able to work, and lost everything I had. And the boss turned out to be a crook. I went through some people in the program putting down some vicious shit on me, where I had to hire an attorney to clear my name. The state did not even think about checking to make sure whether it was true or not. They convicted me on their word. I've had to deal with a lot of resentments, but I can't afford to keep any of them because they will kill me. I'm acutely aware of the fact that today, the reason I did not die from that poison was God was not through with me yet. I know the program works. I know that I never have to drink again as long as I live, unless I choose to do so, because there's a way not to drink. And when the crap hits the fan, all I have to do is pick up the phone and call another sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, or be involved with some new people coming in, and they give me the answers that I need. You know, I run into three kinds of people in the program. The ones that I want to be like, the ones that I don't want to be like, and the ones that ain't got a thing for me, and I ain't got a thing against them. They're just so-so. I prefer working with the ones that ain't got anything that I want, because they show me what I don't want. And in the process of doing that, they help me stay sober. You know, when David came in the program, I was going through some of that stuff. And David doesn't know the number of times that his conduct and his actions kept me sober. It's not the great big successes that make the difference. Sometimes it's the failures that make the difference. It gives you the knowledge of something not to do. And if you use that knowledge, you can help yourself. I have never been the sharpest marble, nor have I ever been the smartest rock on the block. But I know the program will work if I will work at it. What I have today is a gift that was given to me simply because I became willing to ask. Today I still do not understand my God. And I really don't want to, because if I can understand Him, He can't help me. There ain't much to Him if I can understand Him. But I know that He performs miracles. I told you I'm a 5-time loser ex-con. If you can run my record, and what you get back is I had a sanitation violation in the state of Texas. My parole officer got me involved in going to some juvenile centers and talking to teenagers, going to schools and talking to teenagers, and going to University of St. Thomas and giving lectures to the sociology department. And my qualifications was I had been a very successful failure. I at least told them the attitudes, the belief systems, and the conduct of someone coming out of prison, where maybe they could help them rather than being used by them. Whether it did any good or not, I don't know, but I tried it. The funny thing is, I even got paid for doing that. I got paid $250 a lecture for having been a successful failure. I went through the divorce. I was married to a woman that I married because she got pregnant. She crawled into bed with me. I did not crawl in bed with her. I'm being honest. And I didn't want to marry her, but I married her because I was afraid what the people in the program would do and think if I didn't marry her. And that's a hell of a way to try and start a relationship. I have 3 sons by her. One is actually a stepson that I adopted. proud of all three of them. And they're a joy in my life. She was taking pills to go in the daytime and drinking wine to sleep at night. She was diabetic, and we played with her insulin so she could drink her wine. I was supposed to cover for her and say that she was clean and sober, and I couldn't do it. My sponsor told me that I was going to go to Al-Anon, or he wasn't going to be my sponsor anymore, and sent me to Al-Anon with his wife. Florence and some of the other women there in Houston in the Al-Anon group told me that I was not to make threats, I was to make promises. And I was not to say anything that I wasn't willing to back up. And being a sick individual, I did what they said. I told her I wasn't paying for any more of her damn phony prescriptions. I wasn't buying any more of her damn wine. But I was angry. And told her I didn't give a shit where she got the money, but if she's going to turn tricks for it, she better get some nickel rolls, but that's all she was worth. And she did not like that very much. We had not slept together for quite some time. And I went to bed. And I had a little dog that would not let her come in the room without him waking me up first. And I got woke up with the dog growling. And I knew that she was coming. And she opened the door, walked into the bedroom, told me to get my clothes and get out. The only thing I could think of at the time was, why the hell not? A lot of things happened. She started using my boys to get at me. And my anger grew. And I caught myself when I started to kill her. And it scared me so much that I ran. I didn't know what to do. And what Larry had told me, even though I wasn't on parole anymore, I went to my parole officer. And I told him what was going on. And he called a man, didn't know who he was calling. And I was told, come on, let's go. I wound up in a federal judge's chamber. And they told me I was to stay away. Make sure that my boys had the information they needed to get a hold of me at any time. That my boys did not need to have to live with their father killed their mother. And that I didn't need to suffer the consequences of my doing something like that. And for me to send my child support to the state every month. And I did that. I'd like to say I got over that anger real angry, own anger for her real quick, but I didn't. It was about a year, maybe 2 years. And I came to the realization that she was sicker than I ever was, and now I knew I was sick. And I felt sorry for her, because she had every opportunity to have the program, and she wouldn't do it. She died at 38 years of age because of her drinking and drugging. First statement says she died from a massive heart attack brought on by stress on the heart from her diabetes. It was the playing with the insulin, taking the pills in the daytime, and drinking the wine at night that killed her. I have a good relationship with my boys today. My youngest son, who never saw me drink, in fact, I never drank after he was born, turned out to be a cop. And at the time that he was conceived, if I'd known he was going to be a cop, I'd have had myself castrated. I had that much resentment toward police and anybody in authority. I'm proud of my son. He was a good cop. He was involved in a shootout down in Galveston, and he resigned. He said, they ain't paying me enough to get shot. He's going to school full-time now on his GI Bill. And what the hell he's going to be, I don't know. He may grow up someday. He hasn't grown up yet. He called me the other day when it was 108 degrees here. And he said, guess what, Dad? It's raining, and it's 67 degrees, and I'm wearing a jacket. And then just laughed. And I wanted to kill him. Yet, I'm responsible for that twisted humor that he has. And I know it. I can't help but love him. I like to pass on that I have so many female problems, I need a hysterectomy. I have a wife, an ex-wife, a daughter, three stepdaughters, two daughters that I took in and raised, seven granddaughters, two female cats and a female dog. And I don't need any more female problems. On top of that, I can't find a doctor that can give me a hysterectomy. So if I hit on any of you, you're supposed to have enough damn sense to say not no, but hell no. Otherwise, I wouldn't be interested in hitting on you. I know as well as I'm standing here that the program will work under a lot of strange and unusual circumstances, because I've been through a lot of them. A year ago, December, I had gone to Austin with my wife for her to go to school for some stuff for the government on for her job. And the day she was to finish up school at noon, she asked me to check out of the motel and pick her up at the school. And I'm loading the car up and checking out of the motel. And I started getting the bottom part of my vision turned black on me. I couldn't figure out what was going on. This was about 10:30 in the morning. By 1:30 that afternoon, this eye had also gone, and it was no longer just the bottom. I could just see a little bit out the top, and I was blind. I wish I could say that I've been around the program long enough and have a close enough relationship with God that I turned to God, but I didn't. I blamed God. And it took me about 8 hours to come to the realization that I was not asking God to help me, that I was blaming Him for what happened. Needless to say, I'm not blind. I can even drive. It's just hard for me to drive at night because of the lights. Both retinas had detached, which is very, very, very rare, especially without some kind of an accident or something. And then the retina specialist started explaining the criteria to have a detached retina is usually someone who is extremely nearsighted, someone who has had cataract surgery, and someone who is over 65 years of age. Well, I qualified all three times. And he said it's one in about every 5 million that both of them come loose at the same time. They were able to correct one eye with laser surgery. They had to open the other eye up. They've had to open it up twice. And then the cornea went bad on it, and they had to give me a cornea transplant. It's still not right. And I was feeling sorry for myself because I couldn't see real good with that left eye. And it's got a lot of distortion that I can't read with it. And someone that I knew that's in the program showed up at the Whitney Group. He's known as Blind Fred. And Blind Fred would give his right arm to be able to see what I can see with my left eye. And my perspective changed. And I started being grateful again. I went to the doctor yesterday. He said, well, he says you're doing a little better. But there's nothing we can do right now. Keep putting the drops in your eye. And I see you got the glasses that I wanted you to get. He says, if you don't have those glasses on, make damn sure that you have sunglasses on when you go out in the sun. And they said, later on, we're going to have to operate on your eyelids and get them up out of the way where you can see. And then he explained to me that he wasn't going to do the kind of job like they do on females. It wasn't going to be for beauty. It would be for function. And I told him, well, fantastic. Then I won't have to tell him I come out of the closet. And he just hee-hawed. My wife was sitting there, and she's shaking her head. Oh, no. I have so many blessings. The people that I come in contact with the most are people coming out of prison or coming out of jail on probation. And I understand. And I know they can make it. And they can talk to me a little bit, and they know I know what I'm talking about because they know I've been there. If you've been there, it's kind of hard to not know what to say. If you haven't, you're not going to know what the hell to say. I wish I could say that I have a fairly decent success record in working with them. But I lose more than I get working on the program. I don't get anybody sober. I couldn't even get me sober. But I can encourage them to use the program and to try. But the ones that have made it have really been a blessing. And to see them grow and to see them change and see them become a useful part of society is a fantastic experience and feeling. There isn't any amount of money that you could buy that experience from me with, because I love it and I'm going to keep it. It's yours free of charge if you want to get involved and do it. If you want to know how to get 41 years sober, I can give you the answer how. It's easy. Don't drink and don't die. But if you want to do it with any kind of peace of mind, happiness, and contentment, get in the big book and do everything it tells you to do in the first 164 pages. It does work. God told you that I was never the sharpest marble. In 1970, my parole officer forced me to go to the International Convention in Miami, Florida. I don't know who all was behind it, but I was set up to go down there. Had a ride down there in a silver ribbon limousine. Had my own room in a suite in the hotel. Had standing orders. I could order anything I wanted from room service. accept something with alcohol in it. I didn't want to be there. I was real angry and resentful because I was. And I knew I had to go to the meetings that they had. And I was resentful over that. And there was this old fart in a wheelchair that started trying to get me cornered and run me down. And I didn't want nothing to do with that old fart. If I was as crippled up as he was and old as he was, I'd want to talk to someone young and handsome like me too, but I don't want nothing to do with him. And I was able to get away from him repeatedly. The keynote speaker at that convention was Bill W. And I come in for that. And that old fart in that wheelchair was sitting up behind the podium. And they introduced him. And it was Bill W. This alcoholic did not have sense enough to let the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous 12-stepping. Now, if that doesn't give you some answers as to just how sick I really was, I don't know what will. I know today that I have everything that I need, and my wants are not that important. I would like to share something with all of you. The first time I heard it, it hit me dead between the eyes. And it was the answer as to why I wound up in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and why I was sober. It's a poem. It's called The Touch of the Master's Hand. And it is by Myra Brooks Welch. It was battered and scarred, and the auctioneer thought it hardly worth his while to waste his time on the old violin. But he held it up with a smile. "What am I bid, good people?" he cried. "Who starts the bidding for me? $1. $1. Do I hear two? $2. Who makes it three? $3 once. $3 twice. Going for three, but no." From the room far back, a gray-haired man came forward and picked up the bow. He wiped the dust from the old violin and tightened up the strings. He played a melody, pure and sweet as the angel sings. The music ceased, and the auctioneer, with a voice that was quiet and low, said, "What am I bid for the old violin?" as he held it aloft with the bow. $1,000. Do I hear two? $2,000. Who makes it three? $3,000 once. $3,000 twice. Going and gone," said he. The audience cheered, but some of them cried. "We just don't understand. What changed is worth?" Swift came the reply. The touch of the master's hand. And many a man with life out of tune and battered with bourbon and gin is auctioned cheap to the thoughtless crowd, much like the old violin. Miss a pottage, a glass of wine, a game, and he travels on. He is going once, he is going twice, he's going and almost gone. But the master comes, and the foolish crowd never can quite understand the worth of a soul and the change that is wrought by the touch of the master's hand. I attribute my being sober to the touch of the master's hand. He worked through many alcoholics who gave me their understanding, shared their experiences with me, helped me over the hump. gave me an opportunity to find a belief and a faith in God. I didn't have it when I got here. I knew I didn't deserve it. And I didn't think it because I figured because I didn't deserve it, I'd never have it. But it was a gift, freely given, when I asked. And I don't have anything that any of you can't have if you're just willing to ask. If you want to learn how to live sober and have a good life, many things will happen. A lot of them will just plain flat blow your britches away. And I'm so grateful that I've had the opportunity to experience them. I thank all of you for listening. And I thank a lot of you that had something to do with my getting sober. Cole! David. There's too many of you to mention them all. But all of you know who you are. May God bless you and keep you. And may the program give you the joy and the peace that every alcoholic deserves. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry. Man, every time I hear you tell your story, it's always a little different, and I love that, because I always hear something new, something I haven't heard. But there were two things that struck me as you were sharing tonight. One of them is, I'm pretty damn sure you called me a failure. And the other is, it's a long walk for an old man back to Whitney, so you need to think. Thank you again, Jerry. It's an honor to have you here, and it's an honor to be your friend.
We're a failure for a while.
Yeah, I know. Still can be.
You were a success in helping me stay sober.
Oh, I forgot about Drew. Yeah, it's easy to forget about Drew. All right, chips. We still have some regular chips to give out if we need them, and looks like Gary's grabbing hold of them to give them to somebody. Yoni, will you hand out the chips?
I'm
aware.
I'm Joni.
I'm Joni.
Hi, Joni. At the Meridian Group, we choose to hold a chip ceremony at each meeting to recognize various things of praise. Do we have anyone who would like a desire chip? Try our way of life for 24 hours, or does anyone need to reestablish your sobriety? Anyone here with 30 days of continued sobriety? 60 days? 90 days? 6 months? 9 months? Is there anyone here with an annual birthday who would like to pick up a chip now? Okay, yearly birthdays are celebrated at 8 p.m. on the last Wednesday of the month with the birthday night and speaker.
Thank you, Joni. We do have cake. If somebody would cut and serve while I'm divvying up the money and signing papers, I'd appreciate it. Please remember our 12th tradition, which states that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. With this in mind, remember, everything shared here was shared in strict confidence. Do not repeat it to anyone not here tonight. We are self-cleaning through our own efforts. Please take a moment to help clean up your meeting room. Thank you for allowing me to chair tonight, and let's close in the usual manner. Thank you.
We Drew, would you read us out?
For this of you that see us as sober.
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Keep coming back. It works if you work it.
Stay.
Bye-bye.